In the restaurant world, even the most famous chefs have to be concerned about what's next. The next meal, the next dish, the next customer. But what if they took a step back to think about what's last for themselves? That's the question photographer Melanie Dunay posed to a group of chefs in her 2007 book, My Last Supper. What would some of the world's greatest chefs want for their final meal? Although the answers were surprising and sometimes humorous, she didn't get in everyone she wanted. So this year she has a new collection. It's called My Last Supper, The Next Course. And Melanie Dunay joins me now from our studios at NPR West. Melanie, welcome to the program.
Hello.
And joining us as well is one of the chefs profiled in the book, Mr. Bill Telepan, the owner and chef of Telepan Restaurant in New York City, where he's in our bureau there. Welcome to the program, Mr. Telepan.
Well, thanks for having me.
Melanie, other than featuring different chefs, how is this book different from your last one?
Well, this book is really a wonderful evolution, I think. You know, the world of food has changed, and this time I also included some of the TV chefs, and I even included a chef who has a food cart.
Well, the thing is, asking a chef what their last meal would be, it's a pretty big question now, right? And I noticed there were a lot of truffles. I'm just going to put it out there for people. Mm. A lot of people wanted truffles. A lot of people wanted caviar, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's also, this book is about the pictures. So can you describe for our listeners how you photographed some of the chefs and why you shot them the way you did?
Well, what I did was I went to each chef, and as they revealed their answers, which, yes, there was a lot of foie gras, a lot of caviar, and there was a lot of fried chicken, too. I tried to match their answers with a photograph. So in one case, I might have gone to a restaurant. I photographed a chef making illegal moonshine. I photographed Mr. Telepan, who joins us today, with a big 2,000-pound pig. I sort of went all over the world and tried to show who the chef really was, both with his words and visually.
And, Bill, she's got you standing calf-deep in straw.
Yeah.
There's a pitchfork, there's a giant pig, and you're in your pristine white chef's
and
jacket.
And I just had knee surgery, so
and you're standing.
Spanky was, worrying me there. So it was a lot of fun doing it. So.
Well, help us match up, then, the story behind this photograph. What would be your last meal on Earth?
The vision I have of, like, the setting is very important, I think. And there's this one friend farmer who has this great White House, picturesque White House on a lot of land overlooking the whole valley in upstate New York with a pond, and they have a giant garden that they get food from. And it's just that whole idea of that big sky, kids running around, blueberries and you know, meat on the grill. It's just the perfect setting for me.
I want to read some of what you said here because it sounds amazing, okay? The pig would be rubbed with a lot of cumin, a lot of chili powder and paprika and oranges, lemons, and garlic. It would sit for like 5 days salted and then cook slow so that the skin has that golden color and it's just kind of crackling. The thing I noticed about yours over even other people in the book, you have an emphasis on slow. Like you're really stretching out that moment of your last supper. You're in no rush.
I just want to make sure I get to talk to everybody, hanging out with everybody.
Even your dessert is back-turning vanilla ice cream.
I picture my dad doing that, who's just, you know, he's not a cook at all, but he loves to eat also, and it's just having him back there, like, churning it would be kind of fun, so.
And it's really interesting, the chefs who have the emphasis on the kind of communal and family and atmosphere versus the folks who basically say, I would be there, you know, in my kitchen and making perfect fillets of salmon or something like that.
Well, there were really two camps when I was interviewing the chefs. They're the ones that had sort of the memory meals, the ones, you know, Tom Colicchio said, I really want to have my mother's gravy. And then Grant Achatz had a very fancy Last Supper. And then at the end he said, but how can I have this meal without my mother's chocolate cake? So there was a great juxtaposition between comfort and memory and then just yummy, let me stuff my face with glorious things. But, you know, the drinks were interesting as well. David Chang said, just give me a Bud Light and let me get drunk. Mm-hmm. And somebody else said, let me have champagne with ice in it. And I thought, really? Do you want me to publish that?
Once you had all the answers and you're flipping through, did you at all worry about how it would look in terms of sort of how high-end the meals were? There were lots of things that I've never even, I don't think I'll ever get to eat.
or less. I've never heard of as right. I interviewed. I said, how do you spell that? And what's that? No, I didn't, because through me, these chefs are revealing themselves. So it wasn't for me to judge, or it just was for me to allow them to be who they are.
And they sort of reveal our aspirations, right? I mean, if this is what the best of the best would eat at the end, right? Does that make sense, Bill?
Well, I guess it shows that, like, after hours and hours of serving these high-end meals, in the end, oh, I want oyster with no condiments. I want caviar on toast. You know, very simple ingredients. And it shows me, I think, we all like to cook with our techniques and our different styles that we have. But in the end, the ingredient is so important. And I think that showed in this book a lot.
Bill Telepan is the owner and chef at Telepan Restaurant in New York, and he joined me from our studio there. And Melanie Dunay is a New York-based photographer. Her new book is My Last Supper, The Next Course. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Running marathons can help you build a healthy heart, but there's a simpler way to cardiac fitness as practiced by pythons. They just eat. Python's heart can rapidly grow by as much as 40% simply by devouring a huge meal. I have a little something in my throat just thinking about it. Now researchers think they've figured out how pythons perform this postprandial feat. NPR's herpetology correspondent Joe Palka has the report.
Talk about sedentary. The Burmese python puts a couch potato to shame. To get a meal, pythons employ what scientists call a sit-and-wait foraging tactic. In other words, they lie around in a Burmese jungle and wait for the food to come to them. Perhaps not surprisingly, this can mean months between meals. When they do eat, the meal can be huge, a 40-pound pig, for example. And suddenly, these sedentary snakes switch into metabolic high gear.
Imagine running a marathon for 5 days nonstop. That is what these snakes are experiencing metabolically when they're digesting a meal.
Stephen Secor studies snakes at the University of Alabama, Tuscaloosa. He says all this digesting means the python's heart has to step up its game and pump a lot more blood to the snake's digestive system.
So it responds like any other muscle that's, you know, experiencing chronic use. It grows.
This is the same thing that happens to the hearts of long-distance runners, but to a much greater degree in the python.
Within 2 to 3 days, you can get anywhere between a 30 and 40% increase in the mass of the heart.
As the meal is digested, the heart returns to normal. Leslie Leinwand became intrigued by the python. She's a molecular biologist at the University of Colorado, and she studies hearts, but mostly mammalian hearts. She was a bit intimidated by studying pythons, and then she figured,
why not? Let's build a python colony here.
With the help and advice of Stephen Secor, she built her colony of pythons and started looking for an explanation about why the heart growth occurs. The first clue came from the python's blood.
Within 24 hours after feeding, the blood is like milk. There is so much fat in it that you can't see through it. I mean, it's completely opaque.
This was obviously good fat, so Leinwand asked her junior colleague Cecilia Riquelme to find out what it was made of.
Before she did that, though, she took a big leap and did an experiment that I told her would never work, so she shouldn't bother doing it. And that's the wonderful thing about science. She ignored me and did it anyway.
The experiment was to take blood from a postprandial python and inject it into a mouse. To Leinwand's surprise, the mouse heart also increased in size.
What that meant was that it was more than of academic interest to people who study reptiles and pythons.
It had implications for healthy heart growth in mammals, possibly even humans. As they report in the journal Science, Leinwand and her colleagues have now figured out that it's a particular ratio of 3 fatty acids that holds the key. Simply by injecting the right ratio of these fatty acids into a hungry python, its heart would begin to grow. Leinwand says she faced some skepticism when she started studying snakes.
Most of my friends said, why are you doing this? You know, what is a python going to tell you that's relevant to a mammal? And I said, just wait and see.
Who'd have thought that pythons might hold the key to a healthy heart? Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
Tomorrow, of course, is Halloween, and that means lots of creepy, crawly things on doorsteps and fence posts. But on your dinner plate, it may not be far off, as Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf explains.
Watch what your face does when I suggest a mealworm quiche for lunch or fried scorpions for dinner. That's the big hurdle, getting past the ick factor. Entomophagy, eating insects, is common in most of the world, but in North America and Europe, it's considered gross. Now it's being proposed as a cheap food source and a way to save the planet as world population explodes. Crickets need less feed, less land, and emit fewer greenhouse gases than cattle. Nate Irwin, manager of the insect zoo at the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History, says grasshoppers are 60% protein and about 6% fat, while beef is about 18% protein and 18% fat. And for 100 pounds of grain feed, he says you'll get 10 pounds of beef, but 45 pounds of crickets. Plus, crickets are high in calcium. The rest of the world is far less squeamish about eating bugs. They eat palm grubs in Uganda, fried dragonflies in Indonesia, and tarantulas the size of dinner plates in Venezuela. China has a huge insect menu. Water beetles marinated in ginger and soy sauce, deep-fried scorpions on crispy rice noodles, caterpillar fungus soup. But there have always been bug eaters among us. In the 1990s, the Insect Club in Washington, D.C., served dry-roasted crickets along with the party mix. Even today, you can get a good grasshopper taco in D.C. Nate Irwin says he and his insect zoo colleagues like a good bug feast. During the last 17-year cicada invasion, they fried them, roasted them, sautéed them, and dipped them in chocolate. It's all mindset. Hissing cockroaches molt, like soft-shell crabs. Which are you more likely to consider a delicacy? Does it help to know that hissing cockroaches have a diet of fruits and vegetables, while crabs are bottom feeders and cannibals? Probably not. Every year, the Anthropology Club at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, has a pre-Halloween insect bake sale. This year, it was cicada nachos, grasshopper kebabs, and rootworm beetle dip. Their goal is to show that insects can be party food, not just something on Fear Factor. They want to help people get beyond the ickiness.
Bonnie Wolf is working on a book about the foods of Maryland's Eastern Shore. You can find a recipe for grasshopper kebabs on our website, npr.org. This is NPR News.